in this series, we've been talking about a lot of different historical game changers, people whose lives have changed the way that you and I interact on a daily basis with one another and with God. And today, we're gonna check out another historical game changer. Watch this.
Consider the magnitude of the subject which I am to bring before the house, and when I think, at the same time, on the weakness of the advocate who has undertaken this great cause, it is impossible for me not to feel both terrified and concerned at my own inadequacy to such a task. But I determined to forget all my other fears, and I march forward with a firmer step in the full assurance that my cause will bear me out, and that I shall be able to justify upon the clearest principles every resolution in my hand, the avowed end of which is the total abolition of the slave trade. When our reason has been once convinced, let us determine to act as if these things are true, and we shall gradually find doubt dissipate, and obtain a more settled and deep-rooted satisfaction that they are not idle fables. Yours ever affectionately, I am William Wilberforce.
My name is Brian Wells. I'm on the board here at Crossroads, and it's a joy to be able to be back up here and be able to talk at this halfway point of the Game Change campaign of what your Game Change commitments are actually fueling both in Cincinnati and around the world. It's also a joy this morning just to be able to talk a little bit about one of my heroes, William Wilberforce, and the work that he was engaged in that in a very real way we are carrying on today. Wilberforce was in Parliament for, I don't know, maybe it's about 4 or 5 years before he started to kind of really fully come to grip with what was driving the British economy from an import standpoint and how deeply wrecked he was about what he was learning. For those of you that don't know, into the 1700s for Britain, about 80% of the imports of their economy was being driven by what was called the triangular trade. And it was the slave trade that they were engaged in. What they would do is British ships would leave Britain with their exports. It could be guns, it could be ammunition, it could be textiles. And then they would sail to Africa. And there in Africa, they would trade those goods for kidnapped slaves. They would load their kidnapped slaves onto their ships and, as cargo, and then they would sail to the West Indies, where then they would then trade those kidnapped slaves for molasses and rum and sugar, and then return to Great Britain. And it drove about 80% of the imports of the British economy at the time. And it was so nice and convenient for the British citizens because the part that had the slave trade in it, that was called the Middle Passage. That was well removed from daily British life. All the British people saw was they saw the boats leaving with the guns and the textiles and the ammunition, and then they eventually saw the boats coming back in with rum and molasses and sugar. You know, what could be so awful about that? But the Middle Passage, the one that involved the torture, enslavement, and murder of hundreds of thousands of human beings, well, you know, what are you going to do? That's kind of all the cost of progress, right? Wilberforce became increasingly aware of what the reality of what was going on. And right around that time, he and a friend had started to engage about what the message of Jesus was. And over the course of about a year through study and debate, Wilberforce became a fully committed follower of Christ. And he started looking at the Bible of what God's call was to him as a follower of Christ in the world that he was in. In places such as Isaiah, we see in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17, where God has this command, says, learn to do right, seek justice, encourage the oppressed, defend the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. And so there's very real commands in the Bible there that basically tell us, as followers of Christ, we are not only to avoid inflicting injustice upon somebody else, we are to be actively engaged in fighting injustice in our neighborhoods and in our world. And so Wilberforce became convinced that those words that he would pray on a regular basis, those words of "Our Father who art in heaven, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," was a literal truth that he needed to be praying and he needed to be living out. That his role about somebody who was serious of being a follower of Christ was to be about being part of bringing God's light and God's heaven to earth, even into very dark places. And the darkest place that he could see at the time was the British slave trade that they were engaged in. And so in 1788, young William Wilberforce stepped onto the floor of British Parliament and he proposed the abolition of the slave trade. And he was soundly defeated. And he realized quickly after that that if he was going to make this happen, he was going to need to come at it. He was fighting systems and decades of injustice. He was fighting systems of injustice and he could not fight them in all the normal ways. So yes, should he continue to engage legally in trying to pass laws against this? Absolutely. But he realized he was going to have to think innovatively about this as well. And they were going to have to come at this in different ways. So he continued to fight within Parliament for this for years and years. But he also engaged his community around them. And they were engaged in what most historians look back at now and they say, that was the first ever global grassroots human rights campaign. These people forged a trail that is still being used today. He did things like going to the streets and for the first time bringing the voice of the average British citizen into Parliament by working years and years to gain petitions and gained over a million signatures on these petitions of British citizens demanding the end of the slave trade and then brought those and put those in the face of his fellow Parliament members. It did things like his friend Josiah Wedgwood, whose family would become famous for Wedgwood pottery. He had him create pottery. He had him create a plate that had an image of a slave on it and then had a motto around the end that said, "Am I not a man and a brother? Am I not a man and a brother?" And then they would use those plates at high-class dinners that would be put on the table in front of people and they would have to wrestle with that question. It would do things like, one of the things he knew was that people had a real hard time wrestling with the humanity of the slaves. And so what he did was he gathered a group of former slaves that had been freed, and he organized them into speaking tours. And they would travel the country, giving tours, talking about what slavery was like and what transformation had happened in their life. And they became known as the Sons of Africa that would tour to all these public speaking engagements. They invoked public relations campaigns where he had a friend sneak onto a slave ship and actually diagram a slave ship and the actual inhumane conditions that were on there of the way slaves were stacked like cordwood and cargo on these things. And then they published that diagram in newspapers and on posters around the country. And most historians look back on it now and say that was the first ever global grassroots human rights campaign. And it had an impact well beyond just, British UK proper. So if you know anything about history at that time, the English influence was huge, and the territories that they controlled around the world were vast. And among other places, in India, where England controlled most of India at the time. And they did it through this contract that they hired this company to kind of run most of India for them called the British East India Company. And you can imagine today, it would be basically as if Microsoft, or if the US had conquered India and then had sold it to Microsoft. And then have told Microsoft, hey, you give us enough money and you could kind of run this country and enslave these people in whatever way you want. Just kind of keep the money flowing in. So that's what the Brits had done with the British East India Company. And Wilberforce learned that one of the practices of the British East India Company was to grab young Indian girls and enslave them as prostitutes for the British businessmen in India. And so they had this this embedded system over there of rape for money of little girls. He found out about it. It was so much systematized that the British, and this is on record, the British East India Company had a manual that had been published for their workers over there, and they devoted 48 pages to how you should interact with your underage mistress. And Wilberforce saw this kind of stuff, and he was just wrecked. He was just wrecked, and he could not sync that up with the command in the Bible of how we're to treat others and how we are to be actively engaged in fighting injustice in the world. So he brought kind of all his efforts against that, including in India. And that's why, without any exaggeration, when we talk about the work that the Game Change Campaign is fueling, we say we are following in the footsteps of William Wilberforce and others before him that have been combating these dark places in the world. That we fully believe that that prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, we have a role in that. We have a role in that is that we are to bringing God's kingdom into the darkest nights that exist. And so one of the things we want to do this morning is update you on that work, that if you're a game changer in here today, that your work is actually fueling. And so we're going to do a video that's kind of a quick update of our work that's going on in India. And while we do that, we're going to take up an offering. And, I just want to tell you, and I really, really mean this. I mean, taking up an offering right at this moment, I mean, it could seem like it's like some kind of, you know, kind of like Sally Struthers kind of, hey, you know, let's watch this and cry and then everybody dig deep. That's not what we're doing here. As a matter of fact, if you're a guest here, you know, this offering, it's a time for those of us that are engaged around here. If you're a guest, just kind of pass that bag on by. We're just thrilled that you're here, and we just want to kind of tell you a little bit about the story of what God has called us to do and to be part of as game changers in this world.
मुझे बताया गया जो मुझे शूटिंग करने के लिए लेके जा रहे हैं तो मैं बहुत खुश थी क्योंकि मुझे कभी ऐसा नहीं हुआ जब मुझे लेके चल के इतना अच्छी बात है तो मुझे ऐसा लगा तो मैं रेडी हो गई मुझे ऐसा पता नहीं था जो ऐसा होने वाला है तो मेरे को बहुत खुश हुआ तो मैं इधर चले आया मैं उनको पकड़े रहे
State Department tells us that there are about 2.3 million women and children who are held in forced prostitution. So you should just take the population of the entire metropolitan Cincinnati area, and that's fewer than the number of women and children who are right now ground up in the business of rape for profit.
We do have good laws in place. The problem is that very often they're not enforced. A lot of people have had this mindset that women in prostitution are doing it either because of poverty or either because, you know, they want to do it.
There's lots of poverty everywhere in the world, but you don't have sex trafficking everywhere in the world. You actually only have it in places where it's tolerated by local law enforcement.
The vast majority of the time, we were dealing with children who had been either drugged and kidnapped, kidnapped outright, brought from their parents with promises of a job, and in many cases, convinced by someone who had come into the village that this man was in love with them and that he wanted to marry them and take them away, only to find that they ended up in a brothel.
International Justice Mission is a Christian human rights agency that brings rescue to victims of violent abuse and oppression, victims of slavery and sexual exploitation and other forms of violent abuse.
Just a couple of weeks ago, we rescued a very young girl, and within minutes of bringing her out of the brothel into the car, she turned to our aftercare worker and asked her, "What brothel are you going to sell us to?" And our aftercare worker said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You're going to sell us into another brothel. That's what happens."
What we learned over 4 years is that essentially the kind of work that IJM does to do rescue and restoration, but also to incarcerate perpetrators and deter others from trafficking more children, begins with a foundation of aftercare.
There's a long, hard process of healing and restoration that has to take place for these victims. Secondly, the aftercare is so essential because it's actually what gives the authorities something to fight for. Many of the authorities can tend to think, well, after they've been victims of sex trafficking, they're used up, they can never have a life again, so what's it worth? Why do this? But when they can actually see the way these girls are transformed, then it gives them something to fight for.
Human trafficking is something that no church wants to get their hands soiled up with. But that is basically because there's been lack of awareness. And I believe that Keith and I are called to create that awareness. And the rest is then we just leave it to the Lord to open doors, which He has very graciously done.
When it came to putting into the aftercare part of it, then we sat with each other and we said, in what way can we give quality aftercare? Because, you know, I said, I wanted these girls to have, man, the best house, the best home, the best car, the best chairs, the best kind of things. Because I just believe that, I said, why not give them a second chance?
मुझे पढ़ाई करके मुझे टीचर बनने का पहले से मैं सोच के रखी मुझे पहले से मैं सब मेरा मम्मी पापा मैं उन लोग सब पढ़ती थी ना तो मैं इसे सोचती थी मैं टीचर बनेगी टीचर बनेगी लेकिन ऐसा नहीं हो गया तो मैं टीचर नहीं बन गई लेकिन मैं बन के ही छुड़ेगी
Well, as you welcome a game changer and the director of our India Justice work, Don Jared. Welcome back up here, Don.
Thanks.
You know, there may be some folks out here that haven't met you before, so why don't you give us a little bit of your story here.
Sure. I used to be a narcotics prosecutor. I worked in Western Pennsylvania. In 2006, my family and I moved to Calcutta, India, where I took a job with International Justice Mission. I was the field office director for the Calcutta field office managing what is known as a sex trafficking eradication project. I had a team of investigators, social workers, lawyers, and an admin staff, and our job was to infiltrate the brothels in the red light area to find the presence of women and children who had been forced into prostitution, to collect evidence and to take it to the local law enforcement so that we could rescue the girls and we could put the perpetrators in jail. So we would operate in places like Sonogachi, one of the largest red light areas in all of Asia, and also incidentally a place that from historical documents we know was started by executives of the British East India Company.
So you're over there running the Calcutta office, and how did you get mixed up with Crossroads?
I'd been there for almost 4 years, and it was time to come home. I needed to get my kids back into American schools, and So there was a group of people sort of coming through to see the work. There was a movie producer who had made a film called Born into Brothels. There were some venture capitalists. There was Gary Haugen. And there was this really inappropriate pastor of this church that just said the most amazing things. And to the point where I was actually in a Jeep with him, and I said, "Are you sure you're a pastor?" So we were taking them and sort of showing the work, and one of the places that we took them was an aftercare home. It was at the time the best available aftercare home, which they were doing the best they could, but it needed some help. And introduced Brian to a girl we had rescued from a particularly violent brothel, a place where they kept control of the girls by beating them with clubs. And this particular young lady, we had been able to rescue on our seventh attempt. It took us six failed attempts because the brothel owner was so well-connected and resourceful, we'll say, that he was able to thwart us for six tries. We finally got her out. She told us stories of real horror and seeing her best friend beaten to death. And her whole demeanor was like that of you would expect from an abuse survivor. She just wanted to make herself sort of invisible. She just, you know, would look up like that out of the top corners of her eyes because that's just the situation she had come from.
And I remember I was not on that trip, but I remember I was on a project in another country and got a phone call from Brian and just, I mean, wrecked. Wrecked is the word that you could use from his interaction with Mala and just, you know, kind of a lot of the same question, you know, that Keith's is asking about, what can we do? You know, what can we do? I think actually we even have a confidential photo. Tell us a little bit about this photo of Mala.
This is an undercover. This is a still from an undercover video shot by one of our investigators. And this is the photo that was the concluding photo of the safety briefing we would do before trying to attempt the rescue. And so we had a look at this photo for six tries over several months. Every single time we wrapped up with this photo, and it was like, we've got to get this girl out. And through somewhat miraculous circumstances, we were finally able to by the end.
So you're over there, Brian and Libby are over there, they engage with you on this, and then we decide, you know, we feel like Don is an important piece of our taking our work here kind of to the next level, and Game Change kind of being a significant part of that. So tell us now kind of what Game Change is fueling in the work that's going on over there.
Sure. You know, a lot of times what we think of when we talk about aftercare, folks tend to think, well, we're building aftercare sort of facilities, we're building buildings. And while that is a small part of what we're doing, what we're actually trying to do is we're trying to build girls. We're trying to take girls who are in the position of Mala and take them to the end of an array of services that we could compare to a pipeline, so that when we have girls that have been taken out of the brothel and they are, you know, physically traumatized, scarred emotionally and psychologically, almost no education, just really in bad shape, how can we get them to the end of the process so that they are wholly healed, highly educated, socially supported, economically self-sufficient, and have a changed worldview so that instead of being victims, now they are game changers themselves? How do we get a girl to that point? And we are constructing this pipeline that includes things like, yes, aftercare homes, which provide safe places, also trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, life skills, social enterprise so girls can learn to work and make some money in the process, job readiness training, education, just the things that you need to get them to this finished product. That's what we're aiming at. The investigators that take risks to get girls like Mala out, they don't do this so that we can warehouse these girls. That is not our objective. Our objective is to literally get these girls to the point where they themselves are part of the solution.
And I think one of the kind of the innovative developments that you guys have been working on the last couple of years is not only that, I mean, everybody's always thought that, you know, aftercare is kind of a good thing, that's a good thing to do, but the connection with the process of getting these perpetrators put behind jail for a long time, the connection of aftercare to that.
Right. You know, IJM is attempting to use casework to make the public justice system work for people like girls in brothels who have no power otherwise. Because if they can work in that situation, they can protect everyone. That is the big picture of what IJM is doing. And not because we're very smart, but we sort of stumbled onto this recognition that without high quality aftercare, we couldn't do the casework. We couldn't do it successfully. What I mean is, these perpetrators have months, if not years, to groom these girls through particularly brutal methods so that they have no hope, so that they feel this is their destiny and their fate to do this kind of stuff, to do what goes on behind these brothel doors. And when we go in to do a rescue and we remove girls from a brothel, we then say to them, hey, you know what? We are here for you. We're not going anywhere. You are safe. And we need you to testify against this man or woman in some cases who have been torturing you for years at a time. You know, little 12-year-old girl, trust us, right? Without a girl's testimony, we lose. Without a girl to stand in the dock, which is the witness stand in that system, we lose. Our undercover video doesn't add up to anything in court. You've got to have someone testify. You take a girl out of that brothel and you put her into an aftercare home that is a hole, and she's not going to trust you, and she's not going to testify, and the perpetrator's going to get out on bail, he's going to get access to his resources, and he's going to beat that case, and he's going to go out and he's going to do this again. Aftercare is at the heart of winning this transformation of the public justice system and deterring these perpetrators.
And that's been a total innovative way to think about this, which is really exciting. Another part that I've been really interested in the learning you've kind of come to in the last couple of years is you talk about awaking the sleeping giant. You know, tell everybody what you mean when you say that.
Well, we have, in terms of aftercare progress, in Calcutta, we have pre-existing relationships. So we already have one transition home that's open and has girls in it. It's somewhere between 13 and 20, the number sort of varies. And that's actually a picture of it up on the side screen. That's right outside of Calcutta. And we'll be taking the lead on what is really a model aftercare home that is the sort of parent of this aftercare home, probably by this summer. That is with pre-existing relationships with the Indian church. In Mumbai, we've brought in Keith and Ramona D'Souza, and they are mobilizing the local Indian church in order to engage the church in this work. Let me describe what I mean by that. When I was working as a field office director, frankly, I didn't have much hope that American church folks who would otherwise be drawn to this work could actually engage in a meaningful way. I mean, you couldn't come to an IJM office. The location is confidential. You can't go on raids. I didn't think it was really feasible to have Americans go into aftercare homes. Apparently, nobody gave Andrew Peters, my predecessor, that memo, because he just took Crossroads people and just went into an aftercare home. In the process, he demonstrated that it was possible to engage volunteers in an aftercare home in meaningful ways. But we also learned some things from that process. And one of the things we learned is that the barriers for engagement for folks from the Western Church are tremendously high. Think about it. These girls have tremendous psychological needs. They have tremendous trauma. They don't speak English. They speak Hindi, Marathi, Bangla. We don't speak those languages. They come from an socioeconomic gulf that is tremendous between us and them. We are. If you're in this room, if you're within the sound of my voice, you're the 1%. I'm just telling you right now. They are the 99% in the world. And so it makes it very hard to bridge that gulf. We don't understand Islam. We don't understand Hinduism. We don't understand the government. And we don't understand the culture. So those are just tremendous barriers for what otherwise would be a good opportunity. But what if there was a group of people who actually lived there in Mumbai, and so they wouldn't have to just go for a week, but they could volunteer regularly in an aftercare home? And what if they spoke the language, understood the religions and the culture? What if they had a worldview that said, we should love these girls who are the least of the least and the outcast? Well, it turns out there is an organization, there's a group of people that are just like that, and they're called the local Indian church. And so what Keith and Ramona have been doing is mobilizing the local Indian church, particularly they've connected with four denominations, to spread the word about what opportunities for engagement are available. And it gives us here in the West an opportunity to engage with them, to build into them in areas where they're asking for help on things like, how do we do this counseling? What does trauma look like? How can we plan this out? Things where we're actually wanted, we can engage, and that just creates this multiplier effect with engaging the local Indian church. So we already have an aftercare home in Mumbai that's called a transitional facility. It's fitted out. It's ready to go. We're waiting for a license from the state of Maharashtra. When that comes through, we'll have intake, and then we'll have the next one going in Mumbai.
And so we're able, I love when we've talked about this before, Don, talked about the difference between a lot of traditional, well-intentioned plans for working with these girls versus the idea of actually being a shepherd for them.
Well, yeah, sure. You know, the rap on Christians is, you know, do-gooders in general is that they show up late and leave early. And that's really the story in the developing world. You see an awful lot of facades, a lot of programs that are just there for show. And when you look at the level of difficulty that we're talking about, the degree of difficulty of engaging with these girls, it is not good enough to have people who are phoning it in. It's just not going to get it done. Jesus told a story about himself. He said, I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays his life down for the sheep. And then Jesus backed it up. And that's what we are, you know, exploring over Easter. He actually did it. He says, but the hired hand, he cares nothing for the sheep. And when he sees the wolf coming, he runs away, right? And believe me, there are wolves in this line of work. And we've got to have people who are not going to run away, who are willing to lay their life down. And we see that, you know, we see some heroic individuals in the local Indian church, and they're going to make a difference.
So that's awesome. Why don't we, the really exciting thing is some of the updates that you have for us today of just not hypothetical what could happen, but actually what is happening. And the first one was one that kind of, we didn't go into this kind of planning for this, but it's interesting some of the traction that this is starting to get from a multinational corporation standpoint. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you may know, within a few weeks ago, Google announced that it's giving $11.7 million to IJM. That's a large chunk of change. Yeah, you can clap for that. Go Google.
Yeah, and that is, you know, something I would say here in a very real way. So we've been there on the ground doing this, and your game change commitments are fueling something that is now getting the attention of organizations with way more resources than us. So there's a multiplier effect to what's going on here that's really exciting.
And we're taking that opportunity for corporations that really want to do the right thing, but they're kind of live in fear that their supply chain may be compromised by slave labor. And so getting them on the right side of this issue is you know, not only the right thing to do, but it makes good business sense. You know, one thing I wanted to say is, you know, as we look at Wilberforce and we look at the abolitionist movement, it's really easy for us to think, well, if I'd have lived during that time, you know, I'd have been on the right side of this movement. I'd have been on the right side of the slave trade. Well, maybe you would, but maybe you wouldn't. There's a lot of disinformation that came out during that time. The slavers convinced people that, you know, African slaves, it's tough over in Africa. They really like it when they get on these sort of luxury cruises back to the West. You laugh, but that's what they were saying. They were saying, we're just so glad we've been enslaved. And they're not showing the slave ship Brooks, right? You know, we live in a time not so different from William Wilberforce. During the entire 400 years of the African slave trade, there was a total of estimated 70 million African slaves shipped across the Atlantic Ocean. You know that estimates are today there are between 27 million to 80 million slaves in the world today. Not over 400 years, today. The cost to purchase a slave in today's dollars during Wilberforce's time was about $30,000. It's about $300 today. You and I are living in the heyday of the slave industry, and we have to make a choice. And there are guys in here who need to think through the choices that they're making. Are we going to support a sex industry that just destroys lives, or are we going to stand against it? So I think it's just true.
Yes. Yeah, and I, you know, that's part of my journey of getting involved in the entertainment industry, because that's part of the lie of the porn industry too, guys, I'll tell you.
It is.
This is all part of the same darkness, and we can try to kind of pretty it up in different ways. Not true. You're drinking a lie, and you're drinking poison. Now, what's exciting about this is not only have these multinational corporations started to become engaged in this because they see that it's right for their bottom line as well, but we're also starting to see kind of the fire spread here in the U.S. as well with other faith-based groups and churches.
I don't think Crossroads really realizes how much of the vanguard you all are as far as actually engaging your people and getting really a deep dive into this issue of justice in a difficult environment. And Crossroads doesn't do 50 things. We do two overseas initiatives. And there are other churches that are coming alongside saying, hey, how can we engage our people too? How can we go on this kind of a journey too? So you and I are going to Washington, D.C. in just a few weeks.
Yeah, just a couple weeks. BWDG in the D.C. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be off the hook.
Yeah.
Off the hook. Party rockers in the house. Yeah. That's right.
We're going to order room service and watch American Idol, probably.
Yeah, I think that's what I meant by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. But, well, why are we there?
We're going to be going to a conference put on by IJM called Basecamp, which was the marketing materials actually designed by our folks here at Crossroads. There's 30 churches coming that are you know, potentially they want to be game changers too, and they're saying, "Hey, come along. You've been on this journey a little farther than we have. Help us to, you know, not make the same mistakes that you have. Help us to fully engage." It's really exciting to think about the power of engaging the church in the U.S. with the local Indian church and getting the best out of both to create not just the drop in the bucket that, frankly, all of Crossroads resources would be against over 1 million children in forced prostitution, but to create a movement that will sow seeds that will bring about an end to this madness in India.
So that's exciting. We've got about 35 other U.S. churches who are wanting to get together in Washington, D.C. and talk about what this model looks like and how they can kind of be engaged in this. And we were also hoping to try to engage a similar kind of number of local Indian churches in this as well, from kind of a groundswell standpoint. And I'm gonna share a number here, you know, and I am not, this is not a typo, okay? So, you know, just realize this. So we were hoping, we've got 35 U.S. churches here that are looking to become engaged in this, and we're hoping to kind of start to spread that to an equal number of Indian churches in this as well. And through Keith and Ramona's work, you know, I just found out earlier this week that we now have over 1,000 Indian churches that have stepped forward and said that they want to be engaged in this. We have over 1,000 communities that say that we want to be that shepherd and we're not scared of the wolf. Yeah. Insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
You know, I think one more item of good news that we've had recently is with regard to Mala, the girl that you've seen the photo of and that Brian met. She is in an aftercare home awaiting the end of her court case. And she's had an opportunity to receive really quality services. And her demeanor is not what it was. I haven't seen her for I think a couple years, actually, and she, I'm told by Smita Singh, her aftercare director, that she's not looking down at the ground anymore. She isn't doing this peering around thing. She's actually quite confident now. She has, she's finished her beautician's course and done so well that she's actually going to be teaching that course at the Crossroads-funded aftercare home, the transitional home, to other girls. So it's just been tremendous progress. And that's the cool thing, is right now we're finally at the point where we can start to get the cool stories. I mean, before we were working hard, it was just all infrastructure and behind the scenes, but now, and I think you'll see this with all the initiatives, we're starting to get to the point where the coolness is happening.
And there was one more button on the Mala story me is particularly motivating.
Yeah, so I'm talking to my former colleagues there, and I said, because her brothel manager is real connected, got this owner, he owned 8 other brothels just like it. Is he still in jail? And he said, yeah, he's still in jail. And all the girls are testifying against him. And he's not coming out. He's going in and he's not coming out.
That is awesome. That is awesome. And one of the things I love about engaging with you and or it's Keith or Ramona or whoever on this is the stories of hope. The stories that this is, you know, hope that is going into these dark places, and it's a joy to be on this journey with you. Don, thank you for being the tip of the spear for Crossroads on this.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Don's over there. No, no, tell them to stop. Tell them to stop. He always gives me his not a hero speech. He's going, I'm not a hero. Not a hero. You know. Absolutely, and you guys are too. All you game changers out there, this is what you're involved in. The thing that I love, now I mentioned that I love when I'm engaged with our folks on this, is the stories of hope. You know, this is not, we are not talking about hypothetically how we might be able to do something about this. It's actually happening. It's actually happening. And yes, will it take time? Absolutely. We are engaged against long-term systems of injustices here. It will take time, and it will take innovation. Some of the things that Don was talking about, that's not the normal way this has been come at. We have to think different. We have to think innovatively about this if we're going to be about changing the game, not just doing better at playing the game that's already out there. It'll take innovation on the way that Don and others are doing the work. And you know what? It will take innovation on the way that those of us are providing fuel for that work, the way we think about that as well. You know, one of the things that's known about William Wilberforce is not only how he engaged his entire life on this, but that he was born a very wealthy man and he died penniless. He died living with relatives because he had been so engaged in this. He did radical things at that time, like sell the family country home and all these ways that he could engage in this. A lot of us in here, we're not called to do that, but we are called to think innovatively about the way we can be part of some of this. We are called to have that conversation with God. It says, God, what is my role in this? It may not be the role that Don has. It may not be the role that Brian has. It may not be the role of others have. But what is my role in this? I know for Nancy and I, this has been something we've really wrestled with, just in the last 6 months. So, you know, we made our game change commitment, what was it, a year and a half ago or so, you know, whatever that it was. And then about 6 months ago in the work that I'm involved in, made the decision that for what I felt like God was really calling me to do, I was going to need to leave that and start something else. And it made for a really tough financial situation in the Wells house. I mean, we really had to say, you know what, I'm confident we're supposed to do this, but we're really going to need to tighten the belt. Now, you need to know a little perspective here. When I talk about tightening the belt in the Wells house, the baseline that we're kind of coming from, you know, can be, you know, kind of a bit scary, you know, for my wife and others. I have friends who talk about, again and again, they'll talk about what they call the bunt pan story. The bunt pan story when Nancy and I first got married about 20 years ago. And it basically looked something like this. A couple months after we were married, Nancy and I were in the store, and she wanted to make the special cake, and she wanted to buy a bunt pan, you know, like a $7 bunt pan. And I'm just like taken back. What? What? We already have a pan. We already have a pan in the house. Why do we need another one? This is a perfect example of our American consumeristic driven culture. There's no way. It became known to our friends as the would Jesus buy a bunt pan story, you know, in the house. So, you know, I'm, you know, kind of, and, you know, I see some ladies looking at me right now, you know. Need to know, relax, the bunt pan was purchased, you know. I gave it to her as a 10th wedding anniversary gift. It was, it was such a moment for us. No, I think the tide changed on that conversation when she said something to me like, well, would Jesus pay extra for ESPN? I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. What is this, Russia? You know, no, let's not get crazy here. So that's kind of the baseline that I come from. I can tend to be not, you know, kind of a really free-spending guy, you know, in the first place. So when we made this decision about 6 months ago, Nancy and I started really wrestling, and we're sitting down. I always call these seasons of prayer and spreadsheets. You know, prayer and spreadsheets. How are we going to make this work? How are we going to make this change? And we can continue to make our game change commitment that we've made. And so, you know, when I think of this, this is what I always think about, you know, kind of with kind of some of the decisions that we kind of made since then. So this is, you know, like, you know, one of the, you know, like shopping bags we have in our house from groceries and such. We were kind of taking a look at things, and I realized when I looked at it that I was spending about $5 a day on lunch. When I go to work and then I like run down to Subway, you know, whatever, I spend about $5 a day on lunch. And I realized that if I could cut my lunch spending down to $2 a day, if I could spend $2 a day on lunch, and that added up over the month, we would be $60 closer every month to being able to fulfill our game change commitment. So I did kind of the rough numbers, and I realized that not only would I need to just start packing my lunch, but that I would need to eat peanut butter and jelly. you know, as part of this. So, and I, you know, kind of like peanut butter, but so I said, okay, you know, I'll eat peanut butter and jelly. And then the real innovation, Don, that I'm particularly proud of in this, was this bag, because I realized I'm not going to be like one of those free-spending yuppies out there buying a brown paper bag for my lunch. No, I'm going to actually use the bags we already have in the house for free. So this became part of my kind of $2 lunch plan that I did. And, you know, I got to say, you know, I like peanut butter, but I did have a conversation with Nancy, you know, the other day where I said, you know what, I'm not there yet, but I'm pretty close to being sick of peanut butter. You know, I'm pretty, pretty close to being there. But let me tell you, that is not a burden. That is not a burden. As a matter of fact, when I eat lunch every day and I pull my stinking peanut butter and jelly sandwich out of this, I got to tell you, I get more pleasure from that lunch than any gourmet meal you could put in front of me. And I bite into that sandwich, and I am tasting joy. Because I know when I'm eating that, I know I'm not just sitting there eating my sandwich. I am changing the game. And so some of the best meals that I'll ever eat is sitting at my desk with that bag and that peanut butter sandwich. And it's not that this is a message that's telling you to stop eating out. That is not it. It's a message that's telling you is that we all are on our own journey. We all have to ask those honest questions. And we all have to say, God, what is it for me? What is it for me to show up on this one? And what does that look like? I love, the way Keith and Ramona talk about this. You know, a little bit of background on Keith and Ramona was that Ramona was working at the Indian National Stock Exchange, and Keith was helping lead a large marketing firm in Mumbai, among other things, working on the Nokia and the Samsung account. And Ramona decided to leave her work at the Indian National Stock Exchange to be engaged with these girls. But she didn't kind of like fully tell Keith what she was doing, because she thought maybe he would think like it's too dark and dangerous or whatever. So she wasn't like totally open with him about that. But she started doing this work. And then she decided at some point, I've got to engage Keith on this. I've got to get him enrolled in this. So she decided to do it by tricking him. And yes, all your wives are writing down right now. She decided that she was going to go to this meeting on the weekend that she knew at this home that she went to. She knew they always invited her driver to come in and have tea with them. And so she asked Keith if he would drive her to this meeting. So he drove her to the meeting, they pull up, and then they say, hey, would your driver like to come in and have tea with us? She said, of course my driver would, you know. So she brings the driver, they don't know it's her husband, brings him in, and then sits down, and one of the girls starts telling their story. And this is Keith talking about his reaction to this.
And when they began to talk, I just couldn't believe my ears, in fact, you know, as to, is this real? Because they began to talk about they being sold into sexual slavery, and they were beaten, and they were, you know, raped so many times, and the kind of things that were going on, and I just felt that, which world am I in? I was shocked. My means, I just felt that, you know, I was doing so well in my corporate company and the kind of a career. I said, yes, in our offices, we do hear about people sleeping around with this one or like having an affair with so-and-so, and everything is done so professionally well and everything. But this was a little bit of like being very low and depraved, and the kind of, sadistic pleasure got out of from very young girls, in fact, as old as around about, you can say, 11 years old and 12 years old and above. So I couldn't stomach the kind of news that I was hearing. And I turned to Ramona and I told her, I said, is in what way? Like after everything was over, I just thought, like, in what way can I help? So I says, means, do they need money? Do they need the kind of a home? I'm ready to sell my place. And I'm ready to buy a home for these girls. So my talk with God was like, God, what do you want me to be doing? I had a jet setting career here. And when I went back to work, I just couldn't work. My mind was clouded with the kind of pictures of these girls. And there was one girl that transformed my thinking. She was a beautiful young girl of 12 years old. She had such long hair, pretty eyes. She had a red lipstick on, and the trauma that she had gone through, and the kind of, she spoke so less. And my heart went out to her because she had gone through servicing around 25 clients a day. And she had the courage to that. I said, which man, like, what have we come to? And one fine day, I decided to quit. And I told my boss, in fact, that, sir, in fact, I have decided to quit. Why? Sir, I told him, I believe God has called me to be into the field of human trafficking. He says, which God is this that is spoiling my career here? Now, the decision to step out of the boat was a very hard decision, Don, because back home I had to pay my kids' fees because I've got two grown boys, and the huge amount of, you know, the monies that are spent on the college education and the things that they need to be doing. So we've taken on the responsibility of providing for them a good educational career. So all these things are weighing on my mind. Who's going to now bring in the monies, and, you know, with the kind of people whom I've come in contact with, the kind of, you know, people who are wanting to stand beside us, with the kind of a decision that I, when I stepped out of the boat, people just coming and saying that, in what way can we help you? We are not doing this work, but we definitely support the cause. We are there, right there for you.
I love that question that Keith asked there. He's just, you know, the question that I was wrecked with was, God, what do you want me to do? You know, what do you want me to do? You know, I want to let you know, for those of you game changers in here that have been on this journey, and it's not easy, and you've made a commitment, and you've been on this journey, and you may be going in tomorrow morning for yet another 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours standing at the drill press. I want to let you know, you're not just standing there, you're not just punching metal, you are actually changing the game. For those of you that have been on this journey, and you're going to be going in this week, and you're going to be going into yet another management review, and you're going to be walking in a boardroom with yet another PowerPoint presentation, and yet another of wading through all the stinking politics and all it takes just to get something done at work, you need to know you're standing up in that presentation, and you're not just doing a quarterly review, you are actually changing the game. You may be a stay-at-home parent, and you've made some hard choices in your house to fund this kind of work and to pour fuel on it. And you need to know, and maybe your family has a little bit less because of that. You need to know, when you're making your kids lunch or whatever that it is, that you're not just raising your children, you are actually changing the game for others. And if you haven't been able to be part of this thing yet, you need to know you're going to have an opportunity. And it'll be kind of one of those times in your life where you're going to say, what did I do with what I knew? And did I show up? Not did I show up in the way Don did I show up in the way Brian did or Keith did, but did I show up in the way God told me to do? So in 1788, William Wilberforce stood up on the floor of British Parliament, and he put forth legislation to abolish the slave trade. And it was defeated. And in 1789, he did the same thing. And again, it was defeated. And he did the same thing in 1790, and 1791, and 1792, and 1793, 1794, 1795, 1796, 1797, and somewhere along the way, the stakes got even ramped up, because then the British slave traders started enacting the habit of, if they had a sick slave, it wasn't going to mean much for them, actually throw them overboard while they're still alive in the middle of open ocean. In 1798, Wilberforce proposed it again on the floor of Parliament, and it was voted down. In 1799, he did. In 1800, in 1801, in 1802, in 1803, in 1804, in 1805, in 1806, and then on March 25th of 1807, British Parliament voted to abolish the slave trade. And it was just the beginning of the snowball that started to roll for the rest of Wilberforce's life, that culminated on July 26th of 1833, British Parliament voted to abolish all of slavery in all British territories. And 3 days later, William Wilberforce died, empty and full. It's said that that moment, 1 year labor when the law went into effect, was perhaps one of the greatest moment in the history of mankind. That at that moment, 800,000 human beings became free for the first time. It's said that one of the things that some of those 800,000 did in the West Indies, on the last night of their captivity, they all found the largest hill on the island and they walked to the top of the highest hill so they could stand there in the middle of the dark night and look out waiting for the sun to rise, because they knew that the minute the sun's rays hit the ocean in front of them, that they were free for the first time ever. And that is what we are engaged in here. In a very real way, we are engaged of bringing God's kingdom and bringing light into the darkest night. If you're a game changer, that's part of your story. You know, would you stand with me? I'm going to say a prayer, and after the prayer, we're going to sing this song, and we're actually going to have some video on the screen, which is footage that we've shot in one of the worst red light districts that are over there. But when you watch this, what I want you to be thinking of is the hope that we're shining in. I want you to imagine when you're singing these words that this is a prayer of hope that you are praying over these girls, that in a very real way, literally right now as we're praying these words, God can actually be singing a song of hope into these girls' ears, that they know hope is on the way. So I want you to imagine that you're walking the streets of this red light district right now and you're just shining a light of hope into every face that you see.